Blog Talk Radio.
The Ohio State University College of Food, Agriculture, and Environmental Science is a driving force throughout rural Ohio, and in particular, its South Centers located in Piketon, Ohio. The South Centers provides research and educational formats in a number of areas, including horticulture, fruits and vegetables, soil and bioengineering, aquaculture, and business development services. Dr. Tom Worley, director of South Centers, hosts the monthly South Centers Chats. Here's Tom.
Well, welcome back again. Our next session features our speaker from Dallas, Ohio, Thomas Saunders. And Thomas has his own law practice down in Dallas, and he's a native of the county and served people that he has known. And his background includes an undergraduate degree from Ohio Wesleyan University, where he majored in history. And then another little side activity he had up there, he played varsity football 4 years straight, ended up being the team captain his senior year. So congratulations on your football career, a big accomplishment as well. And then he went off to Capital University for his degree in JD, Juris Doctor, kind of like that said, and has been in practice now over 2.5-3 years in Dallas, and I think that's a variety of things. He has his wife, Megan, with him today as well, and she's working, although I think she's involved in economic development office now. So, Thomas, all yours.
Thank you. Just want to thank everybody for having me here today. Thomas E. Saunders, that's the legal name. I go by Tommy with my family and friends, and I appreciate the introduction by Tom, so it's a good exchange there. Have some contact information there. Basically, I'll give a qualifier on this presentation. A lot of the topics I'm going to touch base on, we could have entire semester courses on these topics and the subtopics. Mr. Lippe could attest to that. With that being said, the other qualifier is, in the law, there's a common answer that you'll receive from professors when you're asking questions and stuff, and it depends. Everybody's situation is a little different. So what my goal is today is to kind of go through just some of the topics that you should consider when protecting your personal assets, your rights as a consumer or as a business, and so forth. So just kind of, it's a wide topic, so hopefully I'm not too much of a jack of all trades and master of none, but we will touch base on some topics that I think are important for people to consider. So I think Tom touched a little bit about myself as just went to Ohio Wesleyan University, played football there, was also a member of a fraternity, was elected team captain by my teammates, graduated from Capital University Law School in Columbus, Ohio in 2013, took the bar exam in July of 2013 and was admitted to practice law in November of 2013, where I moved back to Gallipolis and started my own law practice. The reason I went to law school was so I could work for myself. I think that was kind of my goal all along. And there's so many different things you can do. And practicing in a small town in Gallipolis, you have to be open to do a little bit of general practice. So you handle some basic litigation needs, you draw up wills, basic contracts, and I also do some criminal defense and family law. So you have to be willing to do a little bit of everything. One interesting thing is when I went to Capital, I was able to study abroad in Oxford, England, during my first summer, and that was a program through Ohio State University. And now I'm all grown up, got a law practice, married to my wife, have a two-month-old daughter, Emma, and I've got a dog, Tucker. So enjoy the great outdoors, telling some stories, and loving the law. So just a brief overview. We're going to be talking about how to protect your property and your personal interests, and also protecting your rights as an individual. And those go hand in hand, and we'll dive into that. So written contracts and instruments. There's an old doctrine called the statute of frauds that requires certain documents to be in writing. And many of those are real estate, purchase agreements and stuff. They need to be in writing. There are exceptions to that, but the general rule is something that deals with real estate needs to be in writing, and contracts lasting for greater than 1 year. So services, somebody's been hired for 2 years to work at a place, that needs to be in writing for it to be enforceable. Basic contracts. The Attorney General was on earlier this morning, and he said that a lot of this stuff is common sense, and my topic goes along with a lot of common sense, too. You'd be surprised what type of lawsuits come up without terms in writing. I've represented somebody for the $1,000 roof that they end up paying me just as much as what the dispute is because they didn't have anything in writing. So it's one of those things, paying for peace of mind now versus paying for the headache later. I mean, that's the typical thing. Do you want to go pay an attorney a few hundred bucks to draw up a basic document, maybe $1,000 or something like that, or do you want to pay the attorney a couple $1,000 retainer later to litigate a mess and end up maybe paying a settlement later? So, I mean, it's one of those things where you got to pay for the peace of mind, and that goes with business agreements. And so many people enter into business with family members, a basic partnership, oh, let's go buy some cattle together, or go buy some land together and flip it. Get that in writing. Get that. If you have a partnership with somebody, create a partnership agreement. If you have an LLC or something, get an operating agreement. Both those documents lay out how the property is going to be transferred upon the death of another partner. How's that interest play out? And those are things you talk to with the attorney that's drafting it for you. And those are things that sometimes when you're entering into a partnership with family and friends, you don't really consider. What happens if we have a falling out and I want to sell my interest out? How do we determine the price of the interest? How are we going to take care of that? And then the other thing, I mean, you have these written contracts, and if you don't have anything in writing, I mean, I've had cases where people are fighting it out, whether it was a lease agreement or a land installment contract, a rent-to-own, essentially. So, I mean, if you don't have things in writing, then you have disputes over was it a lease or was it an actual purchase agreement. And I've represented aunts versus nieces in these situations already in my limited practice. So I can't emphasize enough how much it would help you to have things in writing. And like I said, that sounds very common sense, and even with family and friends. So one thing to protect yourself is, and this is alluded to by the Attorney General's office and Mr. Lippe that talked about scams, is how are you going to decide, make financial decisions? And you always want to have people that you trust, choosing people that you trust in dealing with money. You go to a banker that you trust. You go to a financial advisor to deal with your money. You want to trust that guy that he's going to actually invest your money properly. And, again, have things in writing. And a power of attorney is a document where you choose an agent to make decisions and act on your behalf. And that can be general authority. You can give somebody the authority to make all transactions on somebody's behalf. And those can include selling real estate on your behalf, going to your bank and writing checks on your behalf, paying your taxes. That power of attorney can be a general authority, granting the person authority to do pretty much whatever on your behalf, or it could be restrictive. You could say, hey, I'm only giving this guy this agent the specific power to deal with only my banking or only the real estate. Ohio law requires you to record this document at your local county recorder's office if you're going to deal with real estate. And that should be every county that you own real estate in or plan on using that power of attorney for. So if the power of attorney is executing a mortgage on your behalf or selling the property, that power of attorney needs to be recorded at the recorder's office. So if somebody's going down the line and doing a title search and an attorney's going through and checking the chain of title, they can say, well, this guy signed for it, but, oh, yeah, his power of attorney is on record here, so that's authorized. So that's one way to make sure that the person has the authority to deal with that real estate. Ohio has an Ohio statutory power of attorney listed under that Ohio revised code section, and they pretty much lay out what a basic power of attorney in Ohio should look like and be enforceable. They're saying, hey, if you follow this example, it's enforceable. This is the power of attorney. This power of attorney is. And the difference between a regular power of attorney and what's called a durable power of attorney is if the principal, the person granting the authority to the agent to act on their behalf, if they become incapacitated due to sudden illness or something, a durable power of attorney will still allow that person to make decisions on their behalf. If they're unconscious or something, they can still go and help deal with the finances and stuff like that. And actually, Ohio's statutory power of attorney is a durable power of attorney. And another document that goes along with that is you can do a revocation of power of attorney. So you can just sign a new document saying, I hereby revoke the powers granted to this person, and they no longer have the authority to act on my behalf. And if you've recorded it, recorded the power of attorney to deal with real estate, I would recommend then recording that revocation, putting people on notice that you have canceled that power of attorney. And you you can make it as different as you want, because you can have multiple powers of attorney, you can have multiple agents acting on your behalf, saying, hey, if one of these person can't do it, the other person can, basically a successor or a backup. Same with financial decisions. You have medical decisions. And you have two main documents that go along with medical decisions. And when you're asked to do procedures and stuff, or you're at the hospital getting ready to have surgery, they're going to ask you, do you have a living will or medical power of attorney? And what a living will is, I mean, it's different than a normal will. It's not really determining where your property goes. It's determining a end-of-life plan. And a lot of them contain DNR clauses or do not resuscitate clauses, where basically it says that, hey, if two or more doctors agree that I can't come out of this permanent condition, then life support will be withdrawn at that time. So a lot of times they contain these do not resuscitate clauses. A medical power of attorney, you're choosing an agent to make medical decisions on your behalf if you become incapacitated. You can also do it without being actually incapacitated as well. But it's basically choosing somebody to act on your behalf to make medical decisions. And a lot of living wills and medical power of attorneys, you can get them a packet put together. And usually what you'll do is you'll provide that the living will trump the medical power of attorney, because sometimes your agent won't be able to make that decision, the end-of-life decision. So. And that one can be recorded in the county recorder office as well. You can actually submit the living will to the health department, so it's on file. And like I said, hospitals will typically ask for these when having procedures performed at the hospital. Another way to protect your property or protect yourself is basic estate planning tools. And I kind of alluded to this. Most people have heard about wills, and a will is just it decides how property is going to be distributed after death. And that's property that's not decided by contractual obligations such as life insurance or I'll touch base on this, but survivorship clauses, pass on death accounts, or stuff that's held in trust. It's property that's remaining after all those other, assets have been taken care of. The other thing you can do in the will is you can choose the executor or the personal representative on who's going to administer the estate with the probate court. That's another thing, you want to put somebody that you trust in that position. And also, you can name, as with the power of attorney, you can name successor executors in case one predeceases the person that, the testator, the person that drafted the will, or had it prepared on their behalf. Wills can be really basic. They can say, hey, I want all my property to be divided among my three children, all remaining property. Or they can get specific. They can say, hey, I want these 10 gold coins given to my nephew. I want the 5 Browning shotguns given to my son. And I mean, I've had it where you can get just as specific as you want, pretty much. If you don't have a will, it's not the end of the world. People are always, if I don't have a will, your property is going to be decided by the law of intestate succession. If somebody dies testate, they die with a will. If they die intestate, they die without a will. And then the law of Ohio in our jurisdiction will provide. And don't want to get too in-depth on that because it varies depending on the family structure, depending if the surviving spouse was the mother of all the other children. If not, then there's all these different formulas that we have to go through. Survivorship clauses. That is a great way to allow you to avoid the probate system and get property transferred pretty much immediately or as fast as you can prepare a document to do so. You don't have to go to the court to get approval. Survivorship clauses you find typically on real estate. A husband and wife will own a parcel of property as joint tenants with rights of survivorship. So if somebody, one of the two spouses pass away, they just have to prepare an affidavit, attach a death certificate that says, hey, this person passed away, they had an interest in this. You take that to the recorder's office, and it covers the chain of title. And you also see these with car titles, too. Makes it easier. You just kind of go to the clerk of court's office with your little survivorship affidavit that says, hey, this person had an interest in the car that I had jointly with them, and they are now passed. POD and TOD, affidavit of and accounts, you can set up banking accounts to be pass on death or transfer on death where your interest in that bank account, as soon as you're passing, will immediately go to the beneficiary of that account. And that's similar to like a life insurance policy. People have, when you do a life insurance policy, you're making a contractual agreement that that person's going to be the beneficiary. I've ran into this where the beneficiary is not named in the life insurance, so then it reverts to what does the will determine in that instance. Trusts, we could spend a whole semester talking about the different types of trusts, but they vary depending on how complicated you wish to get. Some people have their will flow into a trust. A trust is essentially a separate entity. It can hold property and sell property, own businesses. What people typically do is they'll set up a trust where it might start revocable and end up becoming revocable. The difference between an irrevocable and revocable trust, a revocable trust, the grantor or the person creating the trust for the benefit of the others retains some type of ownership in that entity, some control. So you can deed your properties to the trust, you can deed, you can sign over business instruments, you can put your bank accounts in the trust name, and what that essentially does is allow, if it's a revocable trust, the person that created it can still go in there and take it out if they want. An irrevocable trust is one where they've already put it in this trust agreement. The trust agreement doesn't call for them to be able to have the power to remove stuff. It's already owned by the trust. A lot of trust agreements will start off revocable, but on the death of the person creating it, it will turn irrevocable and force a set of events to occur. If you truly want to control how your property is owned and stuff after you pass away, a trust would probably be the more beneficial route. And a lot of times you can have your will, I think I alluded to this, you can have your will, they call it a flow-over will, where anything remaining, any other property that you might have, flows into the trust. And I said you could have specific bequests on your will, and they can be as interesting. You could have some South African gold coins, or you could have the ship wheel clock that you want to go to your mother in the event that you predecease her. And some of these are real examples. And another thing I want to talk about is not sitting on your hands or burying your head in the sand. Don't ignore legal documents that are showing up on your doorstep. If you get a letter in the mail, a demand letter from a business, you need to respond to that. I would recommend taking it to your attorney, somebody you trust, having them review the document, because you don't want to get caught ignoring something and having something come up later. So if you have complaints of your own, there's statute of limitations that you have to have, and there's these statute of limitations. They vary depending on what type of complaint you have, depending if you're filing a breach of contract or a tort claim or a personal injury claim. They all have different statute of limitations. So that's something, if you have your own complaint, you have to be, that has to be in your mind. You can't just wait 5-10 years and say, well, they wronged me clear back then. You have to act upon it. So like I said, respond to demand letters to avoid court expenses. Sometimes somebody sends you a demand letter, you take it to your attorney, your attorney and their attorney can work out a settlement. Everybody avoids court. In Ohio, if a complaint has been filed with the court, the defendant must file an answer within 28 days in Ohio. And typically the answer is just the denial of all the claims in the complaint. And it's a procedure. You have to follow. If you don't follow it, the other side can file what's called a motion for default judgment. And basically they're saying, the court is saying, hey, you haven't responded. We're going to take these allegations as true. So that's where you can't really put your hands under yourself and sit down, or you can't bury your head in the sand, because if you ignore something, they are going to get a default judgment, and then you're going to be stuck in a situation where you're asking the court to relieve that judgment. And there are ways in the Ohio Rules of Civil Procedure to do that for certain instances, and if you find out somebody's got a default judgment against you, immediately hire an attorney to file one of these motions to relieve the judgment. And there's different scenarios, but most of the time is of the essence. The statute actually calls for a time limit. And I have an example where a lady pretty much buried her head in the sand on a foreclosure complaint, owed tax money, demand letters come, she gets a complaint in the mail, makes a phone call thinking that that's enough to answer, and then there's the default judgment against her. But it's one of those things you can try to get the judgment relieved or revived. In this case, you'd want it relieved, but you can get it relieved, and in that way, you can then proceed to fight the case or work out a settlement. Protecting your land. A lot of people rent out apartments or their farm, other person, a trailer even, and a written lease agreement is always best. That goes along with my first slide talking about contracts and having things in writing. If there is no lease agreement, it becomes a periodic tenancy, and the term is based on when the payment is made. So if they pay you every month, then that's the term of your lease with the person. If they're paying you every 6 months, that's the term. And to cancel that, you have to give one period of notice that you're terminating the rental agreement with them. So if you're having a month-to-month agreement with somebody to rent your apartment above the pool or whatever, or the pool house, you got to give them written notice 30 days before saying that you're going to cancel the agreement. If the person's not paying rent or breaking terms of your lease agreement, that's when you're required by Ohio law to give them a 72-hour eviction notice, and you have to serve that either by having a friend or somebody take it and hand it to the person, or just putting it on the door. That typically is the way I have my clients do it, is we'll place the eviction notice on the door, and with technology and cell phone, just have them take a picture to show that it was placed there. I usually try to give them more than 72 hours too, but after an eviction is filed, one thing that people think is they have to move out right away. Until there's a court order, the sheriff can't get involved and move them out or anything like that. So after the 72 hours, if they're still not complying with that, that's when you file a complaint for forcible entry and detainer, which is also known as an eviction. And that's where you're asking the court to set it for a hearing, and you're going to basically get a judgment from the magistrate or the judge saying that you are entitled to possession of the property. And if they still don't move after the judge moves them, then you can ask them to, you can get the sheriff involved. So I put a few legal resources available up here. The Ohio State Bar Association has it's called For Public Section, and they have a lot of cool little fact pamphlets about different areas of the law and stuff like that. Local law libraries are a great resource. A lot of them have forms and resources for you to read. Ohio Supreme Court, Ohio Public Defender, I do some criminal defense work, so they have great resources, charts and stuff. And then here in Southeast Ohio Legal Services, they represent people that might not be able to afford defending like a civil action or something like that. They don't do criminal defense. They do a landlord's wrongfully evicting somebody. They're going to step in and represent somebody that can't afford to pay an attorney. And then I put a few ways to contact me. I'd be happy to answer any questions or anything like that. I've got my email, office phone number, and you can find my information on Facebook.